Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This episode of The BIP Show is brought to you by Brookside Energy. Brookside Energy, one of the most exciting oil and gas companies listed on the ASX, is about to capitalize on record high oil and gas prices. With an existing solid production base and the first of over 20 planned new wells nearing production, Brookside Energy is about to join the ranks of top-tier Australian oil and gas producers. Brookside Energy, working with local communities to ensure sustainable growth and value creation through the safe and efficient development of energy assets. And now, on with the show.
How are you now? You're listening to The BIP Show. BIP is for business, investing and policy. That's what we're here to talk about. Don't forget to hit the subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. I am James Whelan, Investment Manager at VFS Group. And as always, I am joined by Paul Colgan, Director at CT Group. How are you now, Paul?
Hello. How are you, James?
Yeah, mate, not too bad. Lockdown continues. Current recording time is the 27th of July, 2021. It's middle of the morning here. The market is open, and I'll be checking in on bits and pieces. Copper price is up 4% overnight, and by the time you listen to this one, it should be up about another 20%, I'd say, easily giving it some estimations. Now, our next guest is quite funny. I actually have met this fellow once, and it was a very weird sort of circumstance that happened, where it was – I'd seen this fellow on the front page of the business section of the Australian or the Sydney Morning Herald or some rag, leaning up against some ridiculous red car, and then later that evening there was a dinner and drinks was put on by some of the trading community around Sydney and Melbourne, and a few bits and pieces had come from it from all over the place to come and visit that, and I actually managed to meet this fellow. It was probably maybe the only time in my life when I actually met someone off the front page of the business section, and also met him that afternoon. I'm sure that will happen anyway, but you don't judge someone based on the car, and you don't judge someone based on that. You judge the acts, and you judge who the character is, and he's actually one of the nicest people that I've met in this industry, and a good, genuine fellow, and he's done some amazing things. So he's currently Chief Investment Officer of Qatar Investments, Non-Executive Director of African Gold. I'm just reading through a LinkedIn profile here. Tell me if I'm wrong. Executive Chairman of Aston Minerals, former advisor, former broker, current broker, current advisor to Syrah Resources, former Executive Chairman of Syrah Resources. We'll go into a bit more bits and pieces with his history and background as he goes. Former Young Rich Lister. It's fantastic to have him on the show. Welcome, Tolga Kamova, all the way from Melbourne. How are you, mate?
Thanks, James. Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, it's exciting. I've been stuck in a house for the last couple of weeks, and it's been hard to work, and I kind of miss being in the office, and I miss all the camaraderie and the banter. But you guys are about to liven it up, so it's exciting.
Yeah, okay. Well, I do try my best. Have you found that lack, just going sort of off piece on this one, have you found the lack of that social interaction, the face to face, and the, you know, the beers and the things like that is, you know, just that chatter has maybe lacked something out of the broking and the advisory community?
Yeah, mate, you know, this business, it's all about relationships. It's all about, you know, getting to know the person you're dealing with. So it's very frustrating for me, more so in the sense that I tend to like to meet the people that I'm investing in. So I'm not just a director of companies and I'm not just putting things together, but I also invest in others. And over the last couple of years, we're dealing with this COVID restrictions, and it's been difficult. And there's been times, honestly, where I've invested in a company, you know, I've put $1 million in or so, and I've gone to meet the person, and in my head I'm thinking, if I'd have met you beforehand, I probably would not have given you the money. and that's one aspect. The other issue is 99% of the time I'd do a site visit before I committed capital to something, and yeah, the last 18 months, 2 years, not being able to get on a plane and go anywhere, it's been kind of like this business is like playing roulette as it is, but then removing that aspect, not being able to see and feel and understand exactly what I'm looking at is also frustrating. But to be honest, I actually miss more so the just actually sitting down with the brokers and fund managers and getting their ideas.
I see what it is. That personable sort of the social guy, you know, if we could just sort of take a bit of a step back and just sort of see where that all came from, and you know, maybe for people who aren't as familiar with you as maybe some of the other trading community might be, but where did today's Tolga come from those past humble histories?
Today's Tolga probably shouldn't be here, to be honest. Today's Tolga. My dad's a taxi driver. Mum had lupus in her joints, so she couldn't work. Dad literally worked, I don't know, 7 days a week. I only really saw him in the mornings on a Sunday and a Saturday. So my childhood, we didn't really come from much. What did I do? I went to school in a local public school. I was a bit of a terror as a kid, but nothing's changed. Always been very passionate, but I mean, I worked a couple of jobs as a child. I was working in a car wash. I ended up owning a car wash with a mate of mine. I worked at the fruit market. I was a spruiker, so I learned to make markets back when I was about 15, 16 years old. I knew what it was like to move a product depending on pricing and valuation. So kind of, I wanted to be a currency trader. So I went to uni at Monash in Caulfield, and my dream was to be an FX dealer. And again, my background, I don't really have the contacts, and my parents didn't have the contacts or the relationship, so it was really hard to get in that industry. But I ended up taking 5 or 6 years before I got a job at Shaw Stockbroking, so yeah. Which was pretty exciting at the time, and I thought, and I took a massive pay cut to go there. So this is one of the defining moments of my life. I was working at ANZ, and I don't know, I was probably on 80-100 grand a year. So it was okay money for me at the time. And I had a number of interviews. I had about 6 or 7 interviews for a job as a dealer's assistant at Shaw Stockbroking. And I remember I was sitting in a room with 7 brokers, or 7 individuals, 5 of them were stockbrokers that I was going to work for directly. And I was like just in awe of these guys, thinking, you guys move markets, you know, dealing with people's livelihood. I had so much, I'd say, admiration and respect. I want to be you. So I took a job with them. And I'll tell you the way, just kind of, probably could hardly live on it really, but it was about, I was getting paid $27,000 a year, including super. So I went.
Sounds
like you do the math.
Yeah.
Bowling, Tolga, bowling. Yeah.
Can you get to? I know who those guys in the room probably would have been too at Shaw's, mate. And they weren't moving any markets. But yeah, no.
Don't get me wrong. I figured it out later that they were all actually incredibly intelligent guys. But yeah, my perception of what goes on behind the scenes is very different to reality.
Yeah. Now, can you? I know I'm going to give you the lead, and I'm not sure if you like. Telling it, but there's a story that is up there in the annals of really good yarns, mate. Can you tell us the get it back story? It's one that I like to hear. It's just a classic, mate. Can you just please just for us? Is that okay?
Yeah, no, I'll go through it. So it was, I can't remember the dates. Memory on this is kind of a period of my life I want to forget, but I keep getting asked to talk about it. But my I was a stockbroker at this point, and I was a junior. Like I literally had just got my license, and my parents had sold their house and gave me the majority of the money to go and invest. And I did, quite well with it. I can't remember exact numbers; it's been so long. But I was up a couple hundred percent from memory. But the stock that they were and the money and the cash was held at Opus Prime. And the reason why it was there is I didn't really need it to be there. My mistake was I was trying to there was an arb in the market where some of the options, and this is exchange traded options, just normal company options, were mispriced. So I was borrowing stock, selling it, and then buying the options and exercising and making an arb. I was doing this on a daily basis. I was just literally analyzing the market. And sometimes there are opportunities like this that present themselves. But I had all of my parents' assets, all their share portfolio there. And it was all great for a while. And there, all of a sudden I get a phone call one morning. I was on the train, I'll never forget it, from my boss, Alan Zion. And he rings me up and says, Tolga, Opus is gone, your money's gone. And this is like, I was on the train, I was packed. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, well, I'll just pull it out, it's on him. And he goes, no, no, it's not on his, it's on their head. And I was, I'm thinking, what are you talking about? So I got off the train, ran straight to Opus's office, got there, and the doors are bolted. And I'm like, oh my God, this is what? Yeah, you can picture my thought process, picture the expletives. And it wasn't just my parents, but it was my clients. So a number of my clients also had their money there. And I'm like, how do I explain this to everybody? And what do I do next? Anyway, that night I went home. I didn't tell my parents because I was freaking out and thinking there might be a solution. Something will come up. So I didn't tell anybody. I mean, my clients obviously knew, you know, so I was dealing with that, but my parents, I didn't. And the next night I was like, oh my God, I have to tell them. So I went home and sat on the couch, set my parents down. And well, mind you, at this point, I mean, people will probably look at my life now. It's very, very different. My house, my three bedroom house is basically the size of almost my bedroom. Now, so the house that we lived in back then with Barack was actually a two bedroom, and my parents were here from overseas, and I was sleeping on the couch, and they were sleeping in my bed. So we didn't come from much, and we didn't have much, and well, the money we did have, my parents gave me. So to paint the picture, I sat them down in the lounge room and explained to mum and dad what had happened, and clearly my dad, at first they were kind of a little bit of shock, not really understanding, and they're not market people, right? So the only person in the stock market that has any understanding of my family is my brother, mum's uncle. And so I explained it to them, and they dad got up, lost the absolute plot. And, you know, 25, 30 years driving taxis 7 days a week, and he saved this amount of money to buy a house, and he gives it to his son, and his son's meant to be this, you know, smart guy, and I thought I was a smart guy. And I basically explained to him it was going to be low risk, it's all arb stuff, I'm doing these things. And all of it disappears in one go. He literally berated me like you would not believe, and rightly so. And at that point, I would have been happier dead, to be honest. It's hard to comprehend, but just picture your mother and father, and they've given you their life savings because they trust you and believe in you, and then you come back a couple months later and say it's all gone. Just picture her.
And not even from the arb trading, from the actual fundamental broking that it was in too. It wasn't in like just the,
well, wasn't me.
Yeah, the and, hollow feeling.
And think about it, right? So in my head, I'm like, I didn't make the mistake of the deal, the trade, whatever. It was literally just the people that I was trusting that I believed in, that I thought was on him, were basically just lying. So and being deceptive. Yep. So it wasn't my fault, but I copped it. My mother, this is where it gets interesting. At this point, I'm literally just going to walk out and disappear. I'm going to jump off a cliff. Mother turns around and says, son, you know what? You're incredibly smart. I know you are. You've always have been. You understand topics really quick. You get the situation really fast. And whatever situation I put you in, you've always been able to handle. You'll be able to figure it out. She goes, get up, pull yourself together, and go get it back. And she says, there's going to be a day in the future where you spend the money you lost today, and you're going to do it for fun, expecting nothing else but entertainment. And she goes, and you're going to do it again the next day and the day after. She goes, seriously, pull it together and go get it back. And I was like, in my head, I'm thinking, Jesus. I went from being the lowest to the most empowered. Because let's be honest, the most powerful person is the person that's actually got nothing to lose, like a wounded bull. Willing to do anything.
Yeah.
And that's what I was at that point. But as a boy, and I hate to say it, all us men kind of are, when mum comes around, you are still the boy, no matter who you are. you've been in, and I know myself and what my family life has been like, I've been ingrained that when my mother tells me something, all of a sudden I can go and do it. I've got to go do it. I don't have a choice. Like it's
noted.
It's like eat your veggies and Brussels sprouts and whatever you're going to do. Yeah. You just train that way. So mum's influence on me, basically that night, I still remember it, I put my headphones on, and back then it was an iPod, not an iPhone, and went for a run. My dad basically wouldn't talk to me, and mum was just overly positive, overly optimistic, overly like, you've got no choice, you're going to do this. So I went from being basically not wanting to breed to feeling like I was so empowered that nothing was going to stop me.
And that is phenomenal.
And it seems like nothing kind of did.
And on and on I went.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, the things that I've achieved in my life, like if you're married with a couple of kids, you wouldn't be able to take the risks I did. You wouldn't be able to go to the deep, dark Africa and run around Mauritania for a month and, I don't know, sit in Ethiopia in the hotels trying to deal with politicians so you don't lose a license that you're trying to get because someone else is more influential, you know, got first right and lots of stuff. I mean, the things that I've gone through and achieved and seen, not many people should take those risks. Because it's not easy, and it's if you've got responsibilities, it's going to be hard. I was a single guy with my mother telling me that with my parents having nowhere to live, that I was going to do anything possible. So there you go.
There you go. That's a cracking story. Colga, are you with us, Emma?
Yeah. Tolga, just wondering, just quick on the Opus Prime thing. So, how did it shape you in terms of thinking about, brokerages, players in the market, doing the right thing and making sure that they're above board and all that kind of stuff? How did it make you think about market participants?
Taught me a lesson. Taught me a lesson like no other, Paul. You've got to, like, as a person, and I'm speaking from a stockbroker's perspective, from the other side, it made me even more weary of every single document that you're looking at, because you are dealing, and I was dealing with people's life savings, right? It's not just mine, my parents, my clients. So it made you incredibly weary. And one thing I took away from it, and this is, and I give this advice to anybody, when you're playing in the junior end of the market where we're at, like where I sort of sit in, you're already levered. Like there's already serious leverage. You see, one of these companies, I can give you many examples, they're all two-bit, tiny little speculative things. They're going to go drill holes, and you know most of them probably don't work, but the one that does, it far outweighs the risks when it does come in. But you don't need to borrow, and this is my philosophy, and other people got their own perspectives and. But from my experiences, I wouldn't borrow money to go and invest in this space. Because the probability...
It's already jacked up enough.
Yeah, the probability is the downside. The risk return's massive already. And you don't want to get wiped out. Like, the one thing that I do want about this industry, and especially in this end of the market, is as long as you're still standing, as long as you're still able to look, you'll learn, like, from your mistakes. But if it wipes you out completely and you walk away and you're completely, you've been taken to the cleaners and the banks are after you for money on top of it, you're not going to come back.
Mm.
You're going to be weary. You're going to be hesitant. You're going to have bitterness. There's going to be sore thoughts in the back of your mind all the time. So you're not going to take the risk that you probably would and potentially the rewards to come with it.
Can I ask you, you started off in trading and we'll get on to some of the things that you're working on at the moment. Shortly, but you started off in just trading, but now obviously these are more what you described earlier as investments. How do you see the difference between the trade and the investment? When did you cross that line? And do you still think in some ways of the big investments like seven figures that you put into a company? Do you still think of those in some ways a trade, or has the mindset changed around that?
Well, the difference between trading and investment is the time frame, right? basically, if you're trading, you're like, and I see people on Twitter and they put their posts, their daily updates, but I'm sure they've got a portfolio in the background where they've got a longer term view on certain companies.
I hope they do.
Yeah, and because like traders, and I've done this, and I won't go into too much detail about it, but I traded CFDs. This is back when I was trying to make my bankroll back. This is a post mum telling me to go get it back, and I borrowed money on a credit card, and I was trading FX, Aussie, US, Euro, CFDs. US, all the CFDs, non-stop. And I won't get too much detail, but I made a lot of money. The return was ridiculous in terms of from money that I put in to what I pulled out. I reckon it was about 500-700%. No, more.
Good. Just enough to pay the credit card interest.
Yeah, correct. but I pulled that money out and I left 30% of what I'd made in there. And I lost that in a day. The second I thought I knew what I was doing, it was gone the next day. I was in debt back to the CFD provider. And I thought, this is not for me. I can't do this. Because you basically just do not sleep. Because you've got to be thinking about it, looking at it all day, every day. You don't have a life. And I realized, the quality of life versus taking a position, doing your work and understanding a position and understanding the risk of that position is potentially more rewarding. But to answer your question properly, I had a client, one particular client. He was an executive director of Tabcorp prior to just being a trader. And he was a gun. And he was able to switch off from the emotion completely. I don't think when we were trading Telstra calls, puts, bear spreads, bull spreads, all sorts of weird and wonderful strategies on all stock, all in the top 20, obviously. But this guy would hardly ever crack an emotion. Like, he wouldn't get upset. He wouldn't get too excited. It was all just very, very calm energy. And I realized it's hard to do that. You need to be a unique individual. And some people can do it, and that's amazing. But for me, it wasn't my personality. I've got to sit back and actually be able to relax and enjoy a bit of life as well. But yeah, that's kind of what pushed me from trading, is just the emotional talent you require to be able to do that successfully. It's not me.
So when you are invested then in a company, do you think you have that emotional attachment to it, or are you ready to cut your losses when things are not going as well as you'd hoped?
I'll give you an example. I'll try and find an example. There's a company I was buying shares in on market and in a placement, and I had some projects. Well, there were nothing special, but they, the chance was there. But it was such a low valuation. I was effectively buying a shell in my mind, and so it wasn't a massive risk to me in my mind. But the thing is, once I buy, I'm there. Like, it fails, I'm still there. If it goes up, I'm kind of there. So it varies for me in terms of my, how do I put it, in terms of my relationship with the company. So I'm stuck. But the size and volume that I'm in, unless the company's turning over millions and millions and millions of shares and dollars a day, then it's going to be very difficult for me to get out anyway.
Yeah, there's no exit. There's no exit without dumping the entire thing. Yeah,
yeah. No. And then you just think about it. When Todd come over buys, people, you tend to think about buying the stock just because I've done it. But, and I want to say this right now before I keep going, what I do with my portfolio is very different to what other people should do. My thought process is very different to everybody else. And I just want to qualify, this is not advice. I'm not giving people advice. I'm just saying what I do.
No, we got a general advice warning on the whole show. It's sort of, it's implied and also stated too. But yeah, go on.
So I'm stuck there. And I'm stuck there to the extent that I won't sell a stock unless something has happened with management. Because for me, I'm buying the guy, really, at the end of the day. I'm buying into the person. Because most, let's be honest, a lot of these projects, drill programs, it's a lot of risk. And the probability of it coming off, like turning into a Bellevue, is very, very small. But I'm trying, and I'm looking for it. I'm trying to minimize the risk with everything that I know and the relationships that I have. But if it doesn't turn into a Bellevue and it falls over, I'm still there. And the company needs to be recapitalized, potentially needs to look for a new project. So I've got to go help in that process. So I'm committed to the person and to the business, whether it be the particular project I invested in on or whatever comes next. But the only time I tend to sell is if, and I'll qualify this, is when management have told me one thing and it turns out it's another. And that's, and I would say all cases, there are times where I sell things just because. There might be a number of reasons why I'm doing it, but majority of the time it's literally just that relationship with the directors.
Trust is so important.
Yeah.
That leads me very nicely into what I'm sure a lot of people want to hear about is what are you like now? What's the next deal? Bearing in mind that thing we just said, general in nature only, general conversation, not advice.
general advice absolutely goes across the whole thing. So what's the next deal, Tolga?
You know, the strongest thematic in Australia and so globally right now is energy. Anything to do with electrification and the reduction in fossil fuel to create that energy is probably front and center for every investor's mind. If you're not looking at it, you're not paying attention to it, you're going to be left behind. I mean, we'll probably go into more of the macro and structural themes and that sort of stuff later, but just investing in that space. And one of the things I've recently done is anything to do with lithium-ion batteries. So anything to do with lithium, with cobalt, nickel, graphite, we'll talk about Syrah later, manganese. So from the actual lithium battery, anything to do with the electrification. So looking at different uranium opportunities. Then the other one that the last couple of years I've been thinking about and been pegging these licenses for a while now is the silica sand.
Yeah.
For the PV solar cell industry. And that market, I think, is already exploding and is going to continue. So I'm associated with I put a deal together a couple of years ago with a gentleman by the name of Julian Babazzi and put some assets, silicon sand assets in WA, into a thing called PEC, Petrol Resources. And I know the influx of inquiries from the Chinese, Japanese, and Korean trading houses and solar panel manufacturers is amazing. Like, they're seeing massive growth. And you've got this sort of divergence, and you're seeing it in a lot of commodities at the moment, where the supply is getting constrained due to environmental reasons, due to quite a number of reasons, and diminished supply. Sand typically is mined from riverbeds from Indonesia, Malaysia, all through that part of the world, but they've been restricting them. They've almost got cartels on this stuff right now. And Australia is in such a unique position. There's quite a number of high-quality silica sand deposits on the east coast of WA, and a couple in Queensland, by the way. But that is an opportunity that I don't think anyone's paying attention to. But when the mainstream market, when my fund managers realize, and once the offtake deals are done and the funding's in place, and they're real low capex operations, so you don't really need a massive funding exercise on these things. It's going to be front and center and potentially print a lot of capital.
From what would be new technology to maybe as seen as old technology, but still an amazing company, Brookside Energy, an exciting ESG-focused ASX-listed oil and gas company, record high oil and gas prices, an existing solar production base, and the first of over 20 planned wells about to come on production make Brookside Energy a compelling story.
I think we put that thing together a couple of years ago. It was 2 cents, now trading at 12. And like I said, it's got some studies coming out, which I think is going to do real well. The other one that I've just listed is a company called Industrial Minerals. It's quite a number of projects, quite a number of sand projects. It's got a gypsum project. It's, again, the primary focus on this is going to be the silica sand, the high purity sand market. And I don't think it's just these two companies that'll do well. I think across the board, all of them. I mean, I don't understand. I haven't delved into each one of the intricacies of getting these things developed on each of the projects. I don't know the details on all of them, but the sand market, I think, is going to be a big sort of export market for Australia going forward.
This is going to be a really stupid question, Tolga, but what's silica sand used for?
Well, the primary application, which I'm excited about, using a number of things, but it's just glass. The main application is glass, and when it has incredibly low iron content, they use it for the PV solar cells, so the actual glass on the panel. Mm. And that market's growing, and it's probably the main application which I'm excited about. But the supply constraints coming out of China. I mean, I posted this thing on the main river, which has turned into a lake that they produce some silica sand from in China, is effectively just been decimated. There's a Reuters article on it recently that you can go back and read. Just Google sand China lake destruction, and it'll come up, which goes into a lot of detail. But it's got the supply being constrained, and you've got demand blowing up. And you know what happens when you make a market, and those two factors are involved. So that's probably the latest deal that I've been on. There's another one called Firebird, which is another, again, battery thematic, manganese plug, northern Western Australia, just playing to that same theme. But I've got another one that's interesting, but it doesn't really go along that thematic. It's basically just with some iron ore assets that we've been sitting on for quite a number of years now, which we're probably going to bring to market to IPO. Over the next sort of couple of months, which are really interesting. And the iron ore price is where it is today. I mean, there's all sorts of fundamental and structural shifts that occurred to take the price where it is. And there's probably a number of things which will bring it back down at some point.
Do you know what the cost of production is? Have you got an estimate for that?
No. This is a brand new play. I can't talk about it until this prospectus is completed and put out. But it's going to be interesting, and it'll be... I suspect there's a lot of demand for this one.
Can I ask you, so one of the features of the Australian market is all these tiny little resources speculators, like tiny, tiny things, a guy in a metal detector kind of size of company, you know.
and a big bag full of mistruths, right?
That's it. So what I'm really interested in hearing from you is how do you think about like separating the what looks like an interesting investment, but given that there's so much of these ultra micro cap, and some of them are just garbage. They've got they've got a license over a bit of land, but they might say that they think that there's X or Y deposits on it. But there's no certainty. So, and because what's interesting here is what you were saying about, overseas investors trying to get into this space. There's lots of hungry capital out there. But so how do you assess those opportunities?
You could say management, right? But management, there's a saying that I have in the office, and I tell everybody. It's like, it's not the man that makes the deposit. It's the deposit that makes the man. All these guys that are out there looking at their projects and they haven't been drilled, they don't know what's there. Like they can make all these assumptions. They can do all the geophysics. They can do all the soil sampling. They can do all of that stuff. But until you drill it, you just don't know. It's obviously the managing director's job to promote it enough to get enough capital to go and drill the holes and hope that he gets it right, hope that it's there. And then all of a sudden, you become a rock star. Mm. Right? So these directors... some of them that I know probably don't deserve the accolades they're getting, and some do deserve the accolades and what they've achieved. But it doesn't matter because the deposit makes the man. I've experienced it a couple of times in my life. But in terms of seeing the different assets, it's really a couple of things. Well, would I like getting to know the directors and the individual in charge who's actually going to drive it? If they succeed, do I want to go and have a drink with them? Do I actually want to celebrate them? Are they a nice, good people? Like, are they good blokes? He's probably one of the top of the list. And then from there, it's just analysing every single opportunity for its merit and what commodity it's in. Do I think the commodity price potentially will save not a tier one deposit, just because if the commodity price goes up, does it make it economic? And it's one thing to find a deposit, it's another thing for it to be incredibly economic to the point where you want to build it and develop it and sink the capital to actually and the infrastructure to have an operation. So yeah, there are quite a number of factors, and I couldn't go through all of them. It's, you know, it depends on which commodity you're in, what grade it is, what depth of deposit is. Is it a porphyry? Is it an epithermal? Is it, you know, a BIF formation? What it all depends.
Going into a little bit, sort of keeping it broad but not too specific on the bits and pieces, do you have, and then I'll go into some talk about graphite, mate, but the do you have models in your shop about exactly sort of where you see things going? Like you're saying, so if it comes in as a tier two or a tier, like a lesser tier holding that's under the ground after all is said and done, and you've got a model that says that this is going to set X, how are you pulling those models together?
So you do it each one individually to understand exactly what you're sitting on and what the costs are to develop it and operate it. There's sometimes operate projects come in and they're just not big enough. But then you go and use your relationships to see if there's an operating plant around you that you can do a deal with. A typical example is a thing called Firefly. Now, the first resource came out, a couple hundred thousand ounces, gram and a bit. It's nice. But then you're like, okay, well, we're not going to develop a mine off the back of this. We're not going to build a plant. But there's a plant 30 kilometers away that needs feed. Can you do a deal? Do you have a relationship? You can marry the two of them together, and which is exactly what we've done with a company called Gascoigne. And, you know, it's in probably 6-9 months that thing will be, processing that ore and obviously earning income and profit from it. So it really depends, and there's, you know, so many ways to create value. Like, it doesn't need to be a tier one. Obviously, that's what you're looking for and that's what you hope for, but it doesn't need to be.
And where are you modelling your actual base metals and resource prices from?
Oh, you know, I don't really look at it too closely in terms of the actual individual price, because this market, it's cyclical. One day, and I'll give you a perfect example. Look at New Century Resources, one of mine that we put together. We bought the assets off MMG. When we raised the money originally for that, zinc price was like $1.60 a pound, and the treatment charges, which is what the smelters charge to process your ore, was about $30. By the time we got the project in operation, zinc price was 80 cents, so it's halved, and your treatment charge is $300. So it's almost impossible to predict that. Like, I wouldn't be able to say, oh, it's going to half in, you know, 6 months and the treatment charge is going to go up tenfold.
Yeah.
And no one's making money.
Yeah.
So it's I don't particularly look at the commodity prices, because right now zinc price has gone back to $1.30, $1.35. Now they're making money again. So like that company 12 months ago, not even 12 months ago, is probably, you know, going to hit the wall. And now it's this quarter, I think it's going to make about $30 million. It's $120 million EBIT for the year, is projected.
Yeah, that's the top end. Yeah. It's,
so that's our industry. So people sometimes are like, oh, you know, when fund managers get judged or investors like me get judged, I'm like, I don't control the macro. I don't control the commodity price. All we're doing is making an investment based on the quality of the project. And the macro sometimes suits and we look like rock stars. And sometimes it doesn't, and we don't.
Well, crossing off that, and Jimmy James Whelan, king of the segue, I'm looking at a stock that I used to hold, and I rode this one the up and downs as well, and it's part of your origin story as well, Syrah Resources too, which is one that I sold, and, you know, it was good and profit, but then you don't really look at for a while. It's gone up, and I actually just looked at it the other day. It just hasn't come up on my radar. I looked at it the other day, and it's gone, hold me. Christmas, this thing has absolutely just taken a bit of a jump off the last few days. So the timing couldn't be better. But graphite, obviously doing quite well. Now, we're not going to talk about graphite, although we could do it later. But just talking about this one. Now, it's easy when you're out there and you're holding it and people know that that you are a part of this stock and you're on the Twitter and you're on the Instagram and you're on all the things. It's easy to make yourself a target, especially in this market, in this space, in this country. How do you... Do you find it gets to you? Does it change your thinking? Does it change your rationale when you've got names and people who might just be at you about some of these holdings that you've got and just get that doubt coming at you?
Not when I'm in my positions, no. I've got conviction. Otherwise, I wouldn't be who I am. If I had have walked away at the first sign of being abused or berated or all that type of stuff. If I'd walked away at the first sign of that happening, then I wouldn't be here. Like, I would have walked away a long time ago. I would have walked away when I lost my parents' life savings. And like, my whole life, I've been fighting. Like, I've never been given anything. It's always been it's literally been a fight the whole way here to this point where you guys are, I'm lucky enough to have you guys want to talk to me and for people to want to listen to this. So that's not gonna, I'm not that type of guy. I just don't go away. And it doesn't change my strategy. It doesn't change my thinking. That's not going to get me there. I'm not going to say it motivates me because I'm already so high energy. I don't know if you're from the way that I talk, the way that I act, the things that I do, you can tell I'm like, I've got my fingers in that many different businesses and opportunities and people that I work with. So that's not going to change me at all. Where I'm, where it kind of excites me, it's more of a challenge. Like, what can I do? What more can I do? What more can I see? What more can I achieve? How many more people can I meet to learn about what opportunities they have and what they're thinking? It's probably my biggest skill, biggest talent is the relationships I build and the being able to stand up no matter what comes your way. But in terms of my investments, I don't make the outcome like in these situations. So we're usually drilling holes and exploring for things. It's the outcomes are dictated by Tolgamova. The outcome's dictated by what Mother Nature's done and the geologist putting the holes in the ground. So people that are like going, it's Tolga, I don't do the actual work and I don't drill the holes and I didn't put the gold or the nickel or the cobalt or the iron ore there. Mother Nature did, and I'm taking a risk putting my capital and my reputation on the line every single time I do it. And people don't understand that. They probably don't understand the things that I've gone through to get to this point where I'm actually able to do it. They probably don't know. I've spent weeks in the deserts in Sahara looking for gold and realizing it's at some point this doesn't make any sense. Or on the border of Somalia and Kenya in Ethiopia looking at for gold deposit where the United Nations are building up peacekeeping camps. I don't know, examples. On the northern Tanzania, driving along where there's all these big black mud flats, which I later found out they're actually just ilmenite. So we went and pegged those. Like, I've been searching for gold deposits in head-high grass in the middle of nowhere in Mozambique. Like, things I've done and seen, so I kind of understand what works when I'm talking to somebody. Just that knowledge is, I've got that experience. I know what should work, what could work. And in terms of making my assessment and risk assessment, I've got a bit of an effort.
When you're doing business in those parts of the world, one thing that's very different is, Australia is really famous for having lots of process, right? Lots of process, lots of forms, lots of applications, approvals that are different in emerging countries, particularly in Africa. How do you manage all that risk? But with things like troublesome or corrupt officials, or how do you deal with all that stuff?
It's all relationships in that part of the world. And I think if you go there with the right attitude and the genuine attitude that, if you do find something, the local people are going to be rewarded and compensated for it. And if they genuinely feel that you will do your best to make sure there's an outcome for them. The way I look at it, really, when someone gives you a mining license in Africa, it's not your land. They're just giving you a right to dig some of their dirt up and take it away. Those people have been living there for thousands of years. Right? So I think of the example of Syrah when we're going for our mining license and we're basically doing all the compensation payments for all the farmers where the people that had their crops on top of the deposit. These crops, these plots of land have been the same family, same for you know, their dad's dad. And when they were explaining it to me, I was like, how do I, all you guys have given us permission to come to your country, to your land, and dig some of your soil up. It's almost like a gift, to be honest, because I just think about my grandparents in Turkey and my grandfather's farm. Someone come up, turn up to try and dig a hole in it, take some of the rock away, he would be pretty scared, number one, pretty worried, probably paranoid, thinking they're going to do something to it. That's not going to be untoward. And he'll be thinking about his family, the next generation, the generation after that. So it's actually just having the right attitude and making sure they feel comfortable. And again, relationships, being able to explain the process properly is probably the forefront.
You said earlier that you don't really pay too much attention to the macro environment, etc. But obviously you do keep an eye on what is happening in commodity prices. And like, so it has been a very, very interesting year. You mentioned iron ore, but also we've got oil, you know, where it is, copper looking very strong. There's a lot of questions about, you know, whether supply chain constraints are squeezing prices a bit. Do you think we're in a bit of a super cycle at the moment? Are we at base camp, or do you think it might come off soon?
You know, with negative real interest rates, you're not going to hold cash, and most people aren't, I should say, but you're not going to hold debt positions because effectively you're just losing money on them. The purchasing power is going through the floor. So you're going to buy assets, which is what's happening. In terms of super cycle, I think we're already in one. If you're looking at the iron ore price, looking at the copper price, it's making these massive moves, you know, 4% in a night. Zinc price, it's gone from 80 cents to $1.35, $1.40. Companies that aren't making money in this price environment are probably going to struggle if you're not already profitable. But yeah, I think we're in spin. Then you've got this massive infrastructure spend that all the governments globally are talking about. I mean, Australia is going to be in such a fortunate position, and it's effectively, I hate to say it, is iron ore price and the commodity prices, especially iron ore price, is making our politicians look incredibly smart.
Yeah, getting kicked,
and they're not.
Kicked in the behind by a rainbow. Yeah.
It's making them look smart. You know, I think the statistic last in June, 50% of Australia's foreign income was the iron ore price. So it's effectively, we as Australians are so lucky that these miners are carrying us out of this headache, the thing called COVID, in terms from a financial perspective. I don't think it's going to do it the whole way, but still, with we're being able to capitalize on it the way we have is carrying us. So that's exciting.
There's also, you know, we do make our own luck a little bit by having great processes, great companies. You know, the processes let us down a little bit from time to time, but we do have great companies that are extremely good. They are, you know, obviously the world leaders in doing what they do, and you know, we've got great people, great engineers, all that kind of stuff. So there's a bit of making our own luck in it, and yes, but we'll definitely take it, right?
Yeah, Paul, I'll say this. I mean, this is why I do this. This is why I invest in this side of this end of the market. People like Andrew Forrest, Fortescue was a shell.
Yeah,
it was a shell company. It was nothing 20 years ago. It didn't exist. Right? Someone invested in that shell. Someone was there. Someone made an absolute fortune backing that guy. How many people does Fortescue now employ? How much foreign income does it actually bring? These little companies that can turn, the potential that it can turn into something like this. Like Bill Beaumont with Northern Star, with his gold, was a shell. I remember buying it like 5 cents. And now look at it. He's built this beautiful business. I'll go along with them. It's merged with Saracen now, but even them, all these little companies, Independence Group, once upon a time, I remember when I first started stockbroking, it was a shell. Like now it's got these people that manage these teams, and they are large exporters of metal from this country. So they're backing those people and fighting those companies are why I actually do this.
Yeah. I've got a last question for you, super quick. Might need to cast your mind back to your FX trading days, but we're asking every guest that we have on the BIP show, And I keep talking about how the first couple of episodes of this season, we did, you know, entire shows on this topic, but it's inflation. And now we're just doing a super quick question at the end. Do you think it's transitory or not transitory?
With the amount of money that's been printed, the money supply that's been pushed in the system, and the sort of spending that's going on currently, and with at some point finding a solution to COVID, you're probably going to continue this trajectory, is my opinion.
So that sounds like another vote for not transitory there, Colga.
Yeah. One of the few, and maybe interesting for rates. Okay, I'm done.
You are done. I think that I am done as well. And just ticking through, Tolga, if there's nothing else to add, I'm going to wrap the show up now, mate, with a short bits and pieces.
One thing I do want to add, I actually want to congratulate. And this is just me hijacking the show for a second. Is Steve Parsons for doing what he's done with Bellevue. He came into that company when it was a 2 cent shell. I think we raised money at 2 cents when he came and joined the board. And the team that he's built, the deposit that he's found, and the way he's carried that forward, and the funding and the his strategy. Is something that I just want to show that I appreciate.
That's sensational. That's very good of you.
Yeah.
Big hat. I'm just thinking of Bellevue. I think I was in after IPO and I got out for about a 10% profit, mate. So that's about as I sort of that thing.
Yeah, no, it doesn't happen every day. I was the largest shareholder. I have 50 something million shares, 56. I can't remember. I mean, I've sold quite a few of them now because obviously it was such a large holding in my portfolio. But yeah, I'm still there in a major way, but he's carried that business, and he's done incredibly well.
Okay, well that's beautiful words, mate. Great sentiment.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming on. I'll just wrap it up now with a quick word from our sponsor, Brookside Energy. One of the most exciting sustainable growth oil and gas companies listed on the ASX for investors wanting exposure to rising oil and gas prices. The stock code is BRK. I've got a chart of the stock at the corner of my eye, and it's going to make a lot of super funds pretty happy today. So don't forget to subscribe to the show, rate us, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on iTunes at The BIP Show. We're on Twitter. It's at @_BIP_show. And we're on Facebook too. Just search BIP Show. I have a website, good for me, which is also hosting all the extras. Tolga, if you could send us the bits and pieces that you wouldn't mind having onto there, maybe something about yourself or the process, or I don't know, maybe just a link to your Instagram account. It's pretty wild. There's that too. And I also go through a few trades and positions, and gee, I reckon we got a few trades for the trade that paid today, Tolga, on that one. Google Wheel and Capital, and follow the links to the BIP Show individually at Colgo. I am at James Whelan 42, and Mr. Kumova is at Kumova Tolga, all one word. So last name, first name on that one. Don't forget to hit subscribe and rate the show. We'd love 5-star ratings, and it's pretty easy to click those 5-star ratings. Thank you, Tolga, for being a guest on the show today, mate.
Thanks, James. Appreciate it, Paul. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Yeah, thanks, Tolga.
No problem. Thank you, Paul. For joining us, Paul.
Yeah, that was good fun.
Yeah, not bad at all. Thank you, Paul, boys. This show is produced by Rick Salter. G'day, Rick. Not many edits today, and we'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.